Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Third Degree Burn. I am Tim Elliott, and we have taken a bit of a hiatus because of, you know, life gets in the way. But we've gathered together most of the team, and we have a brand new episode for this evening. And I am joined tonight with Nigel Spink.
Hello there.
Kirk Greenfield.
Hello. Hello.
And last but certainly not least, Brian Hughes.
How's it going?
This episode is, I think, a brainchild of Brian. I'm going to lay all the blame on you. So, because I think he picked the book, and we are going to, well, I'm going to let him tell you what we're going to cover tonight.
Well, I mean, what I picked is kind of kicking off a run through of the Iron Fist stories. And that we're starting off tonight with Marvel Premiere, issue 25. This is Byrne's first series work, working on Iron Fist. After issue 25 of Marvel Premiere, it rolls over to the Iron Fist series proper. So you get Iron Fist number 1 through 15. And I want to, as time goes on, to cover each issue. And so we're going to start here. Now, did you guys... I'm not assuming anybody got this when it first came out. The thing is, like, I wasn't even aware that there was an Iron Fist series until, I guess sometime in the 90s myself. What about you guys?
I sort of didn't pick it up off the newsstand.
I have a vague memory of seeing this cover showing up at Paramount News. I can't tell you what year this was, but I saw it with all the rest of the Marvel mags. And at that point, since I was in college, I was not buying comics. I was kind of just keeping my distance from them. But the odd picture of the brick wall coming alive, reaching out and grabbing somebody, caught my attention. And I thought, what is this? And then for some reason, I guess I keyed on the fact that Angar the Screamer was involved, and I just put it back up on the shelf. It's like, oh, very good. Good luck, Marvel. And just went about my business. So that's about the sum total of my exposure to the issue. Hmm.
So you didn't like the Screamer then, Kirk?
Well, I don't. I think he premiered in Iron Man. But I saw
Daredevil. Daredevil.
He had been in Daredevil. I don't know if that was his premiere.
Yeah,
but
it was.
It's like since I was not paying attention to comics, I don't want to say I disapprove, but I don't have a love for this period. And so if you name a character Angar the Screamer, it's like, how childish, you know? I just it doesn't appeal to me. So
I knew him as a Spider-Man villain. Mm. I think he showed up there and, of course, from Ohatmu.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen or heard of Angar until Ohatmu came out. And I was always kind of glad that I'd never seen or heard of him before.
He's in that pantheon of like hippie villains. He's from this very set in the 70s.
Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Well, I first came across Iron Fist. I was in the early 70s. I was reading. They were publishing a lot of earlier stories of Marvel in British weeklies. And I was getting one. It was the Avengers version of the British comics. And first of all, though, they introduced Shang-Chi, because I think he came before Iron Fist, didn't he? He was like the first of the Kung Fu guys to get into Marvel comics. And then... they eventually started running the Iron Fist issues. So that's where I first read them. But we got them right from the beginning. So these like earlier issues that you were talking about that were done by like Gil Kane, etc. I read all those in these British weekly comics. So I was aware of the stories. I'd read them, but I never saw the actual American issues until much later. So, yeah, that's where I first read this story that we're looking at today.
Were they color or black and white, Nigel?
They were black and white. But this is the first time. I think this is where I first saw Byrne artwork with these Iron Fist reprints that we got in Britain. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, I saw the Power Man and Iron Fist series. And as soon as I saw my first one, I think I continued to pick those up to the very end. But it wasn't, you know, during the issues that Byrne worked on, you know, that or even the Marvel team up, which I did get later reprints in Marvel Tales, where they reprinted the Spider-Man and Iron Fist and Spider-Man and the Daughters of the Dragon, which were basically the last, would have been the last two issues of the Iron Fist series.
Yeah.
But I you know, picked up on Power Man and Iron Fist a little later. And again, I watched that. I read that series all the way to the end. And was really upset with what they had done to Iron Fist in that.
Yeah.
But obviously, Byrne's got a soft spot for Iron Fist. It was like his first series, so he's got a warm place in his heart for him. And so he made sure that that they got Iron Fist back, and he's been so successful.
They put it right. Yeah.
He's had like three different other series. And there's an Iron Fist and Wolverine, and then another Iron Fist proper. And yeah, they've got some good stuff. I don't know if they've ever gotten that Power Man and Iron Fist back together, though. I'm kind of curious about that. I mean, I haven't read those other series.
I don't.
And yet I seem to have like 10, 15 copies of certain issues in my collection. I guess I need to give them a look-see.
If you don't want to hear, if you want to know more about the our Iron Fist return, then you can listen to Kirk and I's coverage of Namor, because that's the book where Byrne brings him back into the Marvel universe, proper, brings it back to life, basically. Spoilers, but
redresses the mistake that was made earlier.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting because there's an issue of Iron Fist that Byrne apes in one of his issue of Namor, was when he's bringing Iron Fist back.
How and do you mean?
What?
How do you mean?
I don't remember which issue numbers it is, but it's basically an homage. The Namor cover is an homage of one of the early Iron Fist covers.
It's Kirk. I think we talked about it. Namor is punching somebody. It's a replica of
Iron Fist number two.
But you say that Byrne doesn't like the issue?
No, he just didn't like how they got rid of Iron Fist at the end of Power Man and Iron Fist. So
I misunderstood what you said.
He made sure to bring him back. And you know, he did that in Namor. So anyway, let's go ahead and get into this particular issue. There's some interesting things to talk about. This, of course, is Marvel Premiere Iron Fist number 25. This is the last issue of Marvel Premiere that Iron Fist appears in, and I believe he started all the way back in issue 15. Which I think we did with Paul Spataro, didn't we, Tim? Weren't we on an issue of Back to the Bins where we covered that? The origin of Iron Fist?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Gosh, I can't remember what it was. We did Because it, yeah, we because I think it was when the film, the TV show was out. We covered it with them.
That's right.
Yeah, Marvel Premiere 15.
Yeah, and that was the Gil Kane. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was before Chris Claremont started writing. But anyway, let's see. This one here has a cover date of October 1975, on sale date July 8th, 1975, with a cover price of 25 cents. Page count 32, editor Len Wein. The cover credited as penciled by Gil Kane, inked by Dan Adkins. The story is titled Morning of the Mindstorm. 18 pages of story. And let's see. Writer Christopher Claremont, penciler John Byrne, inker Al McWilliams, letterer Karen Mantlo, Popcock. I guess that's her maiden name, Popcock. Colorist Michelle Wolfman. And let's see. Yeah, that's it. Okay. Now, this has been reprinted a number of times. If you've got the Essential Iron Fist Volume 1 trade paperback, you know, the black and white reprint, that's got that along with all the other fun stuff, which has all of Marvel Premiere. It's got issues of Marvel Team Up, Power Man and Iron Fist, and yeah, it's got all that going through there. So you can get that in black and white. Then the Marvel Masterworks, they've got two. Oh, one's a hardcover, one's a softcover. Volume 160, that's all Iron Fist. Then there's the Iron Fist Epic Collection, which is basically the Essentials, but colorized, if I understand that correctly. And then there is an Iron Fist omnibus that came out in 2024. And as we were discussing before the show started, the Marvel Universe by John Byrne, Volume 2, has this story and all 15 issues of Iron Fist. And then it's got the Marvel team-up issues with Iron Fist and the Daughters of the Dragon. So, let's take a look at what else came out by John Byrne the month of October 1975. Nothing. This was it. This is the only thing that he did this month. But keep in mind that this is very, very early in his career. He had not, you know, I mean, well, he was impressing people already with his speed, his ability to get things out quickly. The previous month, he'd done an issue of E-Man where he'd done a Raj 2000 story, I think. He did a story in Fu magazine, I think, that was regarding Jack Kirby. And he did Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch. And then afterwards, he was doing Doomsday Plus One. And again, next month, it's Iron Fist One. But it, October 75 was a quiet month for John Byrne.
No, he hadn't got his foothold yet.
Yeah. So here goes the synopsis. Iron Fist is attacked by Kumbala Bay, the bodyguard of Princess Azir, who'd been he had been shamed when Iron Fist was there to rescue Azir from the monstroid when he was not around. After a brief battle, Azir arrives and breaks it up. Now, all this happened in the Marvel Premiere issue 24. It's just that Byrne didn't do the artwork on it, so we're not covering it. When Iron Fist returns to Li Wing's home, he's attacked by Wing, who's acting strange, thinking that Iron Fist is a demon. He's stopped, and Iron Fist and Raphael Scarf decide to go looking for Colleen, who has been kidnapped. Along the way, the two begin seeing strange illusions and are attacked by the police. Eventually, they come face-to-face with the illusion caster, Angar the Screamer, the hippie supervillain, who attacks Iron Fist with Kumbala Bay. However, Iron Fist defeats them both. He's stopped just before he can kill Angar by Scarf. Iron Fist finds clues on Angar's body that could lead them to Colleen, a Star Trek Enterprise, Stark Enterprise identification card. I see Enterprise, I think Star Trek, sorry. And our story Stark in this will continue in Iron Fist issue number one. As this is the last one that will feature Iron Fist, next issue begins a Hercules storyline. And I'll tell you this, I dug and I dug on Byrne's website, and I really couldn't find much comments of anything on the Iron Fist series directly that was, you know, worth saying, you know, much of anything about here. The things that I was able to find when I was doing my research, though, was I did a little bit of looking up on the anchor, Al McWilliams. Because before reading this issue, I'd never heard of this guy. And I know that he inks the Iron Fist issue one also. And so I kind of figured, well, he must be like a regular Marvel kind of guy. But that's not the case. He does maybe 4 or 5 different Marvel books. But really, I mean, his career started all the way back in 1938, right at the beginning of, you know, the comic book boom or superhero boom. But he spent all his time working on funny books by Dell and a couple Archie books, military comics by Quality, Tip Topper comics by United Features. He even did some work for Warren in their Creepy books, early ones from the 60s. And he did some Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom for Gold Key, where he was primary artist.
He did a lot of Buck Rogers and like Flash Gordon, a lot of sci-fi. I think even some Star Trek stuff.
Yeah, he did that. But the thing is that it stands out to me is that when I see his inks on Byrne, it kind of makes me think of like Dan Spiegel's artwork. If you ever watched like the ever read the Human Target books, with him inking over Byrne, it kind of gives it a very early Silver Age or late Golden Age look to the art. And like one of the characters actually looks like Thunderbolt Ross. That would be Colleen Wing's father. But you can see Byrne's work in there, but it's a bit overshadowed by the guy.
It's got a bit of a house style look to it. And I think maybe that's if that's what Williamson or the anchor
and was told. You can tell by Byrne's work that he is still working on perfecting his anatomy. Especially where it, you know, the midsection, mostly on Iron Fist himself. Everybody else, you know, they're not wearing super tight clothing, so he can fudge that a little. But yeah. Iron Fist, definitely anatomy, needs some work in that area.
I think his layouts are very dynamic, though, for this being early. His storytelling, his kids suffer from the same problems that most Byrne kids do. They look like little people instead of children.
If you look at the kids that Frank Miller drew in the Daredevil books, that's what this reminds me of. But this is actually like 2-3 years before that. But it is Byrne art, and the layouts are interesting, and there's you can see in the layouts that he is a fan of Neil Adams. Now, different from the later issues of Iron Fist and X-Men, this one here, Byrne, is strictly the art robot. So Claremont gives him a full typed up script of what's on every page. So Byrne basically had to make his layout based on Claremont's notes.
I think it works. His vehicles are not as detailed as we would later see in his artwork, where he's very you know, you can almost tell exactly what type of model of car or vehicle when he does his that type of work. And here it just looks like a stock standard automobile that you would see in most comics.
Yeah, it's just a car.
Or I should, for Nigel, I should say bog standard. Isn't that right?
I don't know. Yeah, that's something I'm more familiar with, bog standard. But yeah, I'm just looking at a panel now in the picture, and there's a picture where there's three vehicles, one following another, and you can tell well, one of them's like a Big Mac truck, so that's not too hard to get wrong. The one at the front, just leaving the panel, you can see it's a Volkswagen Beetle.
Is that what that is?
And then the one in the middle.
14.
I've not got numbers on my pages here, but it's in the top left corner of the page. Yeah.
Page 14, Brian.
That's what I said.
And the car in the middle, well, with it being an American model, I'm not sure what it is, but it doesn't look like maybe the car over on the other side of the road from it. So they've got a bit of style to them already. Yeah. And to me, like you said, the police cars, when they're doing the chase, they look like, the standard police cars of the time when we were watching things on TV like cop shows. That's what the police cars looked like. I mean, again, I don't know what make and model they actually were, but whatever it was, it looks like the ones that used to be on TV in the 70s cop shows. Yeah. a sort of like really squarish design, So, no, it's not bad. I mean, something else that I'd not thought about before, you just mentioned it earlier, was the children. And how Byrne doesn't usually draw children very well. But looking at these kids here when they're getting in the way and nearly get run over, they're not bad, actually. I think his children got worse. Look pretty.
Yeah, but they're
pretty decent.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, but
they all have the same size and proportions. It's like saying, okay, they must all be
same age and everything.
Still, it kind of makes them look like instead of
munchkins,
instead of children, they're little people that are dressed to look like children. Yeah.
Munchkins.
Well, it's interesting that he spends, and maybe this is Claremont, but he spends a full page on these kids of the two cars speeding through. They're playing ball in the street, and they speed through, and the kids scatter. Then another car comes through, and they scatter again. I mean, I don't know why they got back in the street. It's like, stay out of the street. You know, the first car came through, and then the detective looks like. Frankie looks a little bit like Hitler at that bottom panel where he says, oh my God, oh my dear bleeding God. And I don't know if that is just him. I don't think he's been affected by the scream yet, right? I don't think he is.
No, not yet.
Not then. It's then later that he starts hallucinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like the next page.
Yeah, because he thinks he's gonna follow him down a dead end alley, and he thinks he's got him cornered.
Yeah, and they're in a school zone too, so they're probably gonna get a double ticket there.
Well, he's got the lights on, so.
you can really see this. I mean, the inks in this really make it look a lot simpler than it is. And I looked at it not just, from what I've got, the digital copy I have, but I looked at it in the omnibus. I looked at it in the essential, which is black and white. And I really think the inks take away something from the art. But then I can't be sure what how good Burns' pencils looked at this point in time. But there's something around the eyes of every character in this that that's what gives me that late golden age feel for Oliver, the Dan Spiegel effect. I don't know what else to call it. The other thing that is so apparent in this issue is that Claremont really loves to fill in the open spaces. Because if you look at just like page two, his, you know, they're not thought or word balloons. They're just, you know, areas for prose. Mm-hmm. And Claremont is taking up as much space as he can to sit there and describe everything.
Yeah.
And then the dialogue, which is like, how can they say all this dialogue while they're fighting and they're doing these really, really fast moves, you know?
Well, a lot of it seems it's not treated like a thought bubble, but it's kind of inner monologue from Iron Fist. Cause it's supposed to be him kind of, you know, he's describing what's going on to us readers, but it's like his inner thoughts as he's getting pummeled by this big guy.
Kumbala Bay.
It's a narration, like a film noir.
It's like a voiceover. It's almost. And that's throughout the rest of the book, and even it's almost like there are points when he's almost answering himself. He'll say stuff like, well, you know what's going on. You know what's something's wrong, or that type of thing, that he's kind of having a conversation with himself. And it does, to your point, Kirk, it is very noir.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's Claremont's.
The, let's see, first page, second page, third page, fourth page, fifth page. The fifth page of the story, which is page 7 in the digital copy, you've got these two guys that are following them around, and he's working for someone referred to as the Fat Man, but it's not the Kingpin.
That's what I thought it was. When I first read that, I thought they meant the Kingpin, but.
Yeah, but you see this guy down there, and he's got some kind of cigarette in a holder, and he's holding it European style. Or he's holding it like it's an opium thing, you know, rather than.
And he's wearing a cigarette. He's wearing like a dickie, so you know he's.
Yeah. But you've got the guys sitting in the car, and the car apparently has a camera of some type that's on Iron Fist. And then to the right of it, what looks to be a taxi cab meter, but I'm pretty sure that's not what that is.
It's a recording device or a recorder or something. It's a spinning wheel of tape, isn't it?
Well, that looks like a reel-to-reel kind of thing, but I'm talking about the little thing above it that almost looks like Herbie's head.
Yeah, it could be. We'll say this, that camera's got a nice zoom on it, because it's 8 degrees zoomed in on Iron Fist's face.
I'll bet you there's a button somewhere on the dashboard that says enhance.
It's almost like the Batmobile is probably labeled.
But it's been so long since I've read Iron Fist, I don't remember what these guys are doing or who they're working for. I mean, I don't know who the Fat Man is.
I don't remember.
No? I think I know who it is. Yeah. But should I mention it at this stage?
Feel free.
I think it's Jaron Hogarth who comes in.
Lawyer?
Yeah.
Oh, the one played by Carrie-Anne Moss in the TV show.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. But, yeah, he appears later in the run of Iron Fist. But at this time, we don't know who he is. But I think it's him. I took it to be him anyway. But these two guys, these two guys, I did read somewhere where it said they kind of just got forgotten about. So we never really know.
The wiki just lists them as Lou and Bernie and doesn't give any. And the Fat Man is listed as the Fat Man, doesn't give his
name. Yes. Yeah.
Crazy. And then what about the Iron Man's image, Iron Fist's image in the bottom right panel? That just looks so wrong to me.
When he's in the doorway?
Yeah.
Wrong in what way?
It's just, I mean, it doesn't look like, and again, it's the midsection area where Byrne seems to have his most trouble with his anatomy. Mm-hmm. And so the pose looks just really off. And yeah, that right there, I think that goes down to Byrne himself, because I think the inker just basically traced what Byrne had drawn.
Mm-hmm.
But and then someone kind of
said, "It's the dragon emblem on his chest is not centered in the V, and therefore it implies that the chest is larger than the uniform that it's bulging out of."
Yeah, I think you're right. That makes the top part of the body look much more massive than the lower part.
Yeah. Has
good catcher.
Has I can't remember because I haven't read enough Iron Fist. In some parts of this, you can see his eyes through the mask. They're not the white, just the white mask eyes that you see in a lot of, like Batman. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Has it always been that way? Has he always been able to see his eyes and his face through the mask? Okay.
Yeah. If you look at the last couple issues of Power Man and Iron Fist, they had Iron Fist in the red costume. And they've got a big cover where it's just him sitting there with Iron Fist ready to punch. And you can see his eyes and around the eyebrows and all that.
Yeah. I'm just looking at page 2 of Marvel Premiere number 16, and there's a panel there where it's a close-up of his head, and you can see his eyes. Yeah.
Yep.
So but when they get close...
But sometimes he's drawn with just the white...
Yeah.
The white eyes, right? Hasn't he?
Yeah. Yep. Because
there's a... Well, there was a famous... I remember there was an ad when I kind of first started reading comics, and it's an ad of Iron Fist, and he's kind of whispering to you the reader. Oh, he's saying, "Hey,
the Dilsenkevich.
Yeah, hey, you better buy our book, or my partner might get upset or something like that."
Yeah.
That's a very dark drawing.
I think they tend to do that with other characters too, that like if they're a certain distance away from you, the reader, you just get that white eyes.
Right.
But when they draw closer up to the face, they do then draw the eyes of the character in as well.
And I can see if they're not wanting to do that, because it would just save them time. Just leave it white like that.
Mm.
Well, also, when they did that, he was always in some kind of relief where the eyes were actually shaded, rather than when the light was directly on him, and you would see, you know, at least his irises or even the skin around the eyes.
Right, and like the first the first pages of this fight in the cover, you don't see his eyes because he's too far away from the camera. It's not until like page 10 where you see
Wing. Where's close enough.
Yeah, Wing is coming behind him with the sword and he dodges.
Does Wing look like Thunderbolt Ross to you?
Absolutely looks like a disheveled Thunderbolt Ross.
Yes, very disheveled. And Thunderbolt Ross would never wear a pink sweater like that. Or is that salmon?
Mine's salmon or kind of an orange. Yeah, and my. I'm looking at the scan, not a redone version of it.
We assume that when
Wing comes and attacks him, it's because he's being affected, right? He sees Iron Fist as some kind of a monster. That's why he's attacking him.
Yeah, like Angar has gotten to him and got him under a spell, and then the police are just being police, apparently.
No. If you're talking about the police that they give chase to, those are not. I don't believe those are police. Those are henchmen, because he says you're not cops until you guessed it.
Well, that's right.
Shot. Yeah. So,
Yeah.
No, they're not being cops. We haven't had Angar introduced to the story yet, but yes, I agree. His effects. I read it that he is affecting, or his after effects are on the professor.
Right. And then they hit Scarf, who's driving.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think these two cops are from the Fat Man. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything with Angar. They're. I don't know what they're doing. They're
kidnapping Colleen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they're looking up in the car.
I guess I didn't make that connection. That's her right there. Yeah.
They're not the guys with the Fat Man though.
They're not.
Well, we don't know employed by him or not, but there seem to be a lot of different factions in this particular issue, and you're being disoriented by the psychedelic, so you're not supposed to make sense of out of it all. At least I couldn't.
Yeah.
But the car that he's driving, the front end of it changes, doesn't it? Or is that...
It looks a bit like a Pontiac because of that front, that split grill. You're talking about
the green? It's got the split grill, but you go two pages. Oh, no, that's the police car that I'm seeing. Good. Yeah, that's got like an Edsel front end.
Yeah.
His or is that a garbage can lid that's just stuck to the front?
That's a garbage can lid. I don't think it's more of a Studebaker front than an Edsel.
Yeah, Studebaker. That's right. Oh. That's listening, Kim.
Mm.
Yeah, and definitely that other car does look like a Pontiac. If I remember right, when they did the Power Man and Iron Fist series, they killed Scarf, didn't they? It was the guy that played Brett in Pulp Fiction. I'm not going to be able to remember his name all of a sudden. And he starred in the movie Career Opportunities. He played Scarf.
Well, apparently at one point he partnered with Gene DeWolf.
And that's I remember that. Let me see. I'm trying to remember the guys.
That was that during Equinox and Yellow Jacket and Wasp, and those are the
Marvel team.
Marvel team ups. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's a Chris Claremont thing.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised.
All connected.
What is that guy's name? Vamp for me, guys. Okay. Exciting vamping.
Well, he was all the way up into Shadowland.
Yeah, but I'm just like
for the Daredevil thing, but I think that when after the car explodes, after Angar has made Scarf, like that's a nice scene too, where he's fighting off this imaginary dragon, and it's like he's holding it back, whatever he thinks he's holding back, and then he crashes the car, and that's a nice shot of the car rolling and on fire, and when he pulls, then the car explodes, and Iron Fist is kind of knocked out, and he. When he, I guess Angar screams again, and he thinks he is in the
Himalayas.
The Himalayas, and he says, when he hits the snow, he goes, "On snow that's so hard, the impact can already pulverize every bone in his body. Snow like more like concrete than snow." And I thought that was nice because he's obviously hitting the street, the concrete ground, but he sees it as snow, but it still feels like concrete. I thought that was nice. A little nod to let you know that, this is all an illusion when he thinks he sees his dad.
Yeah.
But it's
not. And on the next page, they have that kind of Iron Fist sees the Iron Fist skeleton in there. It almost looks like if you made it all red, the costume already looked like Dead Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they've got that image on the very last panel there on page 23 where it reminds me of Silver Banshee.
Yes.
Yeah, the way she paints her teeth on. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the also the scene prior to that where he's first coming under the influence of Angar and he says he's falling. Those two panels before he actually falls through like a portal and hits the snow. To me, that was very Ditko-like, where he's going through this weird kind of maelstrom of shapes and colors. And that I thought that looks like the kind of stuff when Ditko was doing Doctor Strange and he was always drawing these crazy other worlds, you know.
Do you think the color should have used more than pink, purple, and blue?
Yeah, I would.
I'd say no, because the fact that it's somewhat uniform and definitely is not realistic, that's telegraphing to me as the reader, this is a dream sequence or this is supposed to be alien. Otherwise, if it's colored as in normal nature colors, it doesn't look trippy.
Yeah. True.
Yeah, that was pretty trippy. I give you that, definitely. All right. Then let's see.
Well, on the Ryan, that panel where he is a skeleton and he's talking to himself.
Yeah.
Not only does he look like a cadaver, but the dragon tattoo is just a skeleton on the chest. So even it's a skeleton. I thought that's kind of nice.
That was ingenious. Yeah, and I like he's got the skeletal hands pointing at. That's very well done. Now the next page is the first look we get to see of Angar the Screamer.
With his usual Angar effects.
Yeah.
Which is like he's just drawn like it's not finished. Yeah. Like a ghosty type.
But doesn't Angar look like someone that's on Sons of Anarchy?
I mean, he's drawn absolutely like a hippie. He's got the vest with a fringe, and he's got a fringe.
It looks like Tim Roth is wearing a wig, and he's got the headband holding it on.
Mm.
But that's just from what I'm seeing there. And yeah, the psychedelic, well, not psychedelic image, but the Angar's screaming image of the dragon or whatever that is. It looks like when, like in Captain America, when they reproduce Burns pencils instead of inking them. And when he did the 2-page spread, it's kind of what it looked like, what it made me think of at least.
Well, this is Burns done this before, this kind of illusion where there's no a lot of shading. It's just pencils or just thin lines and solid color to give you an idea.
Segmented.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed his hair color has changed on this page, going from long stringing brown, shoulder length brown, into blonde flowing tress in his in the psychedelic part. So it's like if he hadn't identified who he was, I wouldn't have known who this would be.
Yeah.
And the dragon looks a little different than the dragon that Scarf is fighting. It doesn't seem like it has teeth. It just has kind of a maw with, I don't know if that's fire coming out of it. It just has a red mouth.
Yeah, next page, that's going to become more clear.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And the next page, we get our first sample of Kirby Crackle.
Yep.
Yes.
From Burn that I'm aware of. So that was really cool. I don't know. There may be some in Doomsday Plus One, but probably not.
Iron Fist. Yeah.
What do you think at the bottom of page 27 as the wall grabs him? I thought that was very effective to get across the image of the wall coming alive.
Does that look like the Kingpin, though?
Doesn't it? Yes.
Well, with the coloring, it looks a little bit like Ironclad, the one of the UFOs. Yeah. The UFOs.
UFOs. Yeah. But his head's a bit squarer.
Right, his head's not. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, and it's just, yeah.
So as we go through this sequence, the wall becomes Lee Kung, whatever his name is, and then it changes as I read this again to what's the name? Kumbala Bay.
Kumbala Bay.
Yeah. Well, no, I think Kumbala Bay is first pretending to be the wall, and then he's pretending to be Lee Kung until Iron Fist realizes that this guy does not have a death grip. That the guy at the first fight, he said, "Hey, this is my death grip. No man can break it." And he says the same thing, and he goes, "Aha, you don't have this, have a death grip." That's what he knows he's being. It's somebody else.
So when we get to the final page, and this assailant is thrown and hits Angar, are we to assume that there truly were two people there, that Angar was working with this this guard, was this completely in Iron Fist's head?
No, I think he's working with Angar, because at one point Angar, I think, is kicking. At one point, Angar, I think, is kicking. I don't know. When his father, he thinks his father's kicking him. I see that as Angar kicking him.
Yeah. But from the moment that the wall came into that was Kumbala Bay.
That's Angar using his power to make Kumbala Bay look like first a living wall, and then Lee Kung the Thunderer. Yeah,
that's how I read it.
It's how he gets Kumbala Bay to fall on Angar that gives Iron Fist the upper hand.
And this on that page, this Stark International card that he finds. Is that supposed to be Angar, and he's maybe infiltrated Stark International as a...
Yeah, I think
The name, the last name is...
It says David Angar. Yeah, Brian, where did you get the Stark Enterprises from? Because on this card, it says Stark International.
I pulled that
from a wiki
summary off of the Marvel Wiki.
Yeah. Oh, they didn't.
I should have mentioned that.
They didn't look at this either. Then did they? It was still Stark International at the time.
Yeah, because this is right around the time of Iron Man 80, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
and so that's why Iron Man still has the nose.
Yeah, he's got Iron Man's got the nose. Yeah.
As we get to this final page, and Scarf stops him, I was very suspicious that the Scarf was not real either. I was thinking that he was another image, and then I thought, no, it's Tony Stark. Because there's a card that he, it kind of wrapped up rather quickly here, and I was
a little bit
thrown.
Mm. Yeah, but I would blame that on Claremont for how this was done, because again, he wrote a full script
and
how he wanted each page to be.
Yeah. I mean, he clearly defined this is the break point. This is the cliffhanger. And on this page, Iron Fist gets the upper hand. He's stopped by Scarf. Scarf gives him the clue, and Iron Fist, makes a vow he's going to pay. I mean, I got that. He set this up quite clearly. I just wasn't quite sure if that was supposed to be Scarf, a hallucination, or Stark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's easy because your mind's going to go there when you see the name Stark.
Yep.
Well, and you got to
let me ask you guys this. What? Go ahead.
No, to say, when you see somebody with, he's got this handlebar, this kind of not a handlebar mustache. He's got
Fu Manchu
type mustache. When you first glance at it, you think, it's Stark. That's like you said, I think it's Tony Stark, but no.
Well, I didn't catch that this was actually an identification card for Angar, the Screamer, until you guys just said it. I'd never, that didn't register. It's like, where did this card come from? Whose is it? I had no clue. But now it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, in that same page, he says they got away. With Colleen, he goes, they got away, clean away. And we've got three dead cops to show for it. Are we to assume that they killed the three cops that they were impersonating, or where do we see these three cops die somewhere?
We didn't see it.
That's
going to play a big part of future issues, if I remember right.
That there are three cops dead so far in this? Okay, yeah. So I would assume that at least two of them were in that prior police car that they were chasing. I don't know.
They might have killed them and took their uniforms.
Took their place?
Yeah, took their place is what I thought.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is anybody else reading a scan of this, or is everybody reading?
I'm reading a scan.
Okay. There is where is it? I thought it was interesting. It's after page 18. It's kind of a letters page. It's Iron Fistfuls, and they have a little box about, they're talking about San Diego Comic-Con. And at this point, the con is only 4 years old. But it's, I don't know if it's Stan or if it's the editor of it. Maybe this is maybe Lynn Wein. But he's talking about who's going to be at the, how great the previous year was, and that they reported on it in Foom magazine. And it says the star-studded guest this year includes the one and only Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Roy Thomas, George Powell. George, that's Doc Savage produced it, George Powell, because I think the Ron Neely show movie just come out. Robert,
I'm going to give you some terrible thrills, he said to Robert, his bride.
Robert Block, the author of Psycho, Will Eisner, Ray Bradbury, Russell Myers. I believe that's the film director, Russell Myers. Maybe.
Yeah, Russ.
Frank Bruner. I don't know him. Steve Englehart, Tony Isabella, Barry Smith, and I'm assuming that's Barry Windsor Smith, Starlin, and Jim Steranko, and a bunch of others. So that's a pretty nice setup. That's back when it was just a Comic-Con. The TV, the films really hadn't started to. Infiltrating it yet. But that all happens at the El Cortez Hotel in downtown San Diego. So was it even at the convention center?
Right. That's true. I remember some discussion about this, how it grew and moved.
Yep.
Or moved right across the street. I don't recall.
Well, that's interesting. Kind of a little time capsule there about what it was like compared to what it is now.
Well, I think Stan or whoever realized that they could cross-pollinate, that by publicizing where they were going to be and that this was a major West Coast event, that they could draw more folks in or get them involved. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was at the time when Stan was going to colleges and talking up comic books and saying, you know, they're not just for kids anymore.
And collecting it probably, this is 75, so.
Yeah.
Collecting was still a thing, but you could probably get a lot of Silver Age stuff at a pretty reasonable price.
Yeah, you started hearing stories about, Amazing Fantasy 15 going for like $1,000 or, you know, something like that. They would actually wind up in the news when, you know, one of those, like any of the Superman or Batman comic books would sell, though it'd be nothing like what they're selling for today. But it does seem like today that there are people that are purposely ballooning the prices up on those keys. But
bad. $1,000 and 75 is equivalent to 6,000 now. Mm-hmm. I paid 6,000 for Amazing Fantasy number 15.
You're saying you would?
I would. I didn't.
I've got a 1.2.
You've got a
It's slabbed. It's like three pieces of paper that have just been torn up, you know, and pissed on. But it's a 1.2. Will you pay 6,000 for that?
No. You've got Amazing Fantasy 15.
I'm kidding. I do have a friend that's got one. I think it's a 4.3, but I don't think he'll ever part with it.
No,
I think that's going to pay for his daughter's college.
Well, what I heard was what some people do is they will buy And I know there's a guy I listen to, has a YouTube show called Nerdrotic, and he used to own a comic store in San Francisco, and he buys kind of higher end books for his kid as an investment.
Yep.
You know, but he will buy like two low grades and then trade them for a high grade. That's how he kind of moves up. Like you'll get two fours and you might get a seven out of that if you trade them in. So.
Yeah, I've bought one slabbed book so far, and I'm not inclined to keep doing that. I think I just want to buy raw.
Yeah, I don't own anything. I never had anything slabbed. I almost and I think we went to the show together, Brian, I think. It was a Dallas Con.
Yeah, the Fan Expo.
One of those. And Len Wein was there. This is before he passed. And I have a giant size X-Men number one. I thought, ooh, maybe I'll go and have it autographed. And I was reading up about, you know, does it, you know, if you can't get it authenticated, an autograph can sometimes hurt it. And I thought about having it slabbed too. And I've heard things about that too. So I just have it in a Mylar, but. That's the one I paid the most for when I.
There's a new group out here called CBMS that is slabbing, grading and slabbing books. So you can actually take them into them instead of having to package them all up and ship them off to wherever CGC is doing it. And so it's cheap, a lot cheaper than doing the CGC way. And they seem to be pretty well respected. And their books are selling at the same kind of prices. So it's something to look at. But there's also a lot of people that are doing pressing of the comic books and are turning that into a business. So, like, if you've got something that is maybe like a 7 or an 8, and you can take it and get it pressed and might increase the...
Yeah, I've seen people do it. They can repair certain things.
Yeah.
But I've seen stuff that was slabbed that was, it wasn't a particular key issue, but because it was like a 9.5 or 9.6 of just a brand new comic, they'd slab it and then the price jumps up.
Yeah.
Just because I guess, you know, the way comics are delivered to the newsstand, they're handled by three or four people before they wind up on the shelf, that it's rare to find one that's in like really pristine condition.
Yeah, and the thing is, most books, like if you see something that's between $0 and $40, that really means it's probably not worth anything.
No, and there's some books I just want to have. I mean, I'm...
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about a slabbed book.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And because like when I was in Duncanville Books, they had... this whole section of just slabbed comics, but they were all comics. Like they had 10 of this and 10 of that, and, you know, just 10 of like Deadpool issues and other stuff. And it's like, there's no keys here. And the owner says, yeah, some guy just came in and sold all this stuff. He was a speculation buyer. And he says, I got it all for a song. And, you know, the guy was just trying to get rid of it. And now he's sitting there and he's got all that stuff and he's probably I don't know what he's going to do to sell them. He's probably going to have to unslab them and just put them in one of the low price bins. Because nobody's going to pay for that stuff slabbed.
No, not if they're I wouldn't. But I mean, if you want to display them, they're nice.
Right. But the thing is, when people are buying slab books, they're buying keys. They're buying key issues. You know, they want first Spider-Man black costume, first appearance of the Hobgoblin, or, you know, She-Hulk joining the Fantastic Four, or, you know, back from Secret Wars. Or, you know, there's a reason why certain books hold value. And sometimes it's first appearance of a character or it's an event. Now, I don't think Johnny and Alicia sleeping together is going to be considered a key issue, especially considering they retconned it and it's no longer Alicia.
Well, that could make it sometimes
even more desirable.
Yeah, a retcon will make a previous issue more valuable, or it can devalue it because it depends what they've changed, you know, they've done to it. So, you know, and it's always the, you know, I always kick myself for not getting a decent copy of Spider-Man 120. Is it 128? First Punisher.
It
was
129.
It was expensive, you know, but not like it is now. And of course I was, you know, back then when a comic was costing 75 cents and this book might've been $10. I'm like, no, I'm not going to buy that.
And is the one with Nightcrawler on the cover the second appearance?
I believe so.
I picked that up.
I've got that.
I picked that up for like $10, 2-3 weeks ago. As retirement had loomed upon me, my collecting has increased. I don't know why, but I'm picking up a lot more stuff lately.
You know, then the Punisher miniseries hits, and suddenly all his prior appearances are like, that's, there's still one I can't get. It. There's a, I think it's a giant sized Spider-Man.
Oh, it's the annual.
It's the annual or the annual.
Yeah.
And I can get it. It's just not the amount I want to pay for it.
That was the one that Miller did, isn't it?
I can't remember. I just know that it's one that, you know, it's like all of them around it are dirt cheap. And then that one is.
Not sure.
Is it? Yeah. Let me see if I can find that real quick.
It's the one with Moses Magnum.
I think you are right.
Before he became Super Moses Magnum. Yes. Before he became the Magnum in X-Men 118. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see.
So are we just about finished covering this issue?
We've gotten through this issue. We're just kind of talking other bits. But, you know, because, I mean, right now, at least, you know, for me, doing some comic book, you know, bin diving is happening. And I'm trying to complete my collection of Iron Fist issues. Mm. And I'm trying to get also as many of the early Byrne works as I can. Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch, E-Man. Like we said, Iron Fist, I want these Amazing Spider-Man ones also. So Iron Fist, not Iron Fist, but Amazing Spider-Man 15 it was penciled by Frank Miller and inked by Klaus Janson. Story by Denny O'Neill. And the Punisher made appearance here, and he also made appearance in Daredevil. But what he did here was as violent and murderous as, say, Elektra. That's annual 15. That's the one where it shows Dr. Octopus's tentacles holding the Daily Bugle. And the image on the Daily Bugle is the Punisher shooting at Spider-Man.
It's not the one I was thinking of.
Oh,
I know which one it is now. I used to have that one with Doc Ock. Yeah, that was Frank Miller. The one I was thinking of, I don't think it's Frank Miller, the one with Moses Magnum.
No, that's not the one. That had that one. I'm not thinking about that one either.
Mm-hmm.
It's a giant-sized Spider-Man. It's a giant-sized, because there's like five of them, and I have all but one, I believe. I keep hearing a lot of people say that it's kind of a buyer's market for comics, but like these are not, you know, it depends on what you think you're willing to pay for them. But
well, you know, the thing is that when the pandemic hit and everybody was stuck at home in lockdown, all the comic book shops started doing these online auction type things. And when I say auction, I use that term lightly, because they would sit there and say, yeah, we've got this issue here, we're going to sell it for $25. And if you tagged in first, you were the one that actually got it at that price. And there was never any arguing over price. You just got it at that price. So someone couldn't come behind you and overbid to get it. But, the thing that did happen, though, is all these key issues that were getting that were important were going up high because people were willing to pay the higher value for them. And there's a lot more people doing it at the time because that's all they could do. They couldn't go to the stores and dig. And then after the pandemic, kind of fizzled out, people started saying, you know, Eternals number one is not worth $5,000. It's maybe worth $150, which you can't give it away right now, thanks to the movie and how well it did.
Well, but, some of that you have to. I remember Gardner said that he had unloaded all his. I think it maybe just burned all his She-Hulk when the TV show was on because it was super hot. Now, they're nobody wants them now. I mean, they're not dollar bins, but they're not. You know, everybody was kind of riding that wave of while the show was on, it was popular, and then it dies out.
It's funny because as I've been going to the various comic book shops, I keep finding certain issues of She-Hulk up on the wall for like $20 to $50. First appearance of Machismo. I don't think it's actually his first appearance, but his appearance in the She-Hulk book is actually going for a good bit of money. The last issue that Byrne did, I think, was issue 50.
The full cover.
The full cover. And that one's going for like $50 also, which that's considerable.
Yeah. I think the thing I've seen most in dollar bins from Byrne is Alpha Flight. I see that all the time in dollar bins. And I do see some She-Hulk. You don't see anything else of his. Maybe some Next Men, things like that.
Certain issues in X-Men.
Yeah, maybe some MF, that kind of thing.
Now, the first, he didn't draw it, but he wrote it. There's an X-Men issue that's got first appearance of Hellboy. And that's worth a good bit.
Yeah, if only we had known.
That's a Dark Horse Presents.
Well, I've got it. What?
Is that a Dark Horse Presents?
No, it's an issue of Next Men. It's during the Faith storyline.
Right.
And it's got a story where Byrne writes, Mignola does the artwork, and it's got Hellboy.
Right.
And so that's why Byrne gets like partial credit for Hellboy's creation.
Well, that's why I'd mentioned possibly doing a commentary on the first Hellboy movie because it's based on but Byrne wrote. He didn't draw it, but he wrote or he scripted it.
That's how it should be framed. Yeah. Like X-Men 1 or the X-Men stories that he did with Jim Lee, scripted those. He still gets creator credit for Bishop as a result of that. Well, guys, it's been a long weekend for me and I'm starting to go south. So, unless anybody's got anything else they want to bring up about the book we covered tonight.
No, I think we did a good job of covering it. It's good to get back in the swing. We haven't done this in a while because of, things have come up, life and all.
I will say that, number one, about that issue is that, I never find villains like Angar to be very compelling or interesting at all. This one here, it had some interesting things. My favorite image from the whole thing is actually the first page splash where he's dodging the attack from Kambala Bay. The cover, even though it's Gil Kane, really doesn't look that great. And that's just my opinion there. I don't know. And Gil Kane usually is one of the best as far as anatomy and everything goes, but the proportions seem off on Iron Fist.
Mm.
But, beyond that, it does give good representation of what's going on in the story. So that, there's that. Mm. This is that. The first issue that Byrne gets to do. And I think when people looked at this, they go, whoa, who is this guy? And I mean, even with the inker, his characters are still dynamic.
Yeah.
And you can see Burn pops through. You can see it's Burn.
Yeah.
He just hasn't been refined to what we think of as his style. But yeah, I think the layouts, I think, are what make this work. It moves along quick. It's a quick read. It's very cinematic. The action is good. It's very fast paced. Despite Claremont filling it with a lot of words.
I would just like to sort of give a recommendation to any listeners who are listening now and who have never read the Iron Fist stories, but feel like they would like to start, that whilst the issue we've covered here is Byrne's first work on that, this story, this particular story arc, actually began in the previous issue of Marvel Premiere number 24. Yeah. And I would recommend that if you want to read the story and you've not read it before, you start with number 24. As you've already said, it's not artwork by Byrne, but it is the actual beginning of this story. And you will find out a little bit more about this princess. And also, there's an appearance by the main villain of this, who's behind the story that we've covered. I'm not going to say who it is, but you actually see them in that issue as well. So it's worth starting from what would be the very beginning of this story with Marvel Premiere 24.
And if you want to learn who that villain is and you don't want to read the books, stay tuned. We are going to cover this. All right. In a future episode of Third Degree Burn. Kirk?
Yes.
You have any final thoughts?
Not really.
Anybody else?
I want to thank Nigel for turning me on to the fact that this story was found in a black and white version in the Essential Iron Fist. I had not realized that I did have it. So that's another way that you can watch
it. Yeah, I was going to mention that to you, Kirk. When I saw you holding it up, I thought, well, you said earlier you'd not read this. I thought, if you've got that, then it's in there.
That's true. I haven't read this entire Essential. I find the Essentials are tiring because sometimes without the color, it is hard to keep track of who the characters are. Or was that Cyclops Force Beam? I can't tell because it wasn't shaded red. And you follow what I'm saying? It's like I missed the color. And so I can't get through an entire Essential before becoming fatigued.
Sorry. Yeah, I know what you mean. Sometimes just looking at black and white, it can be sort of more tiring. Yeah.
If it's not been drawn to be black and white.
I'm
looking at it and it does seem to.
Because you get a lot of really dark shading in the backgrounds when it wasn't originally meant to be black and white.
It's really weird, especially the image with when he's got the Angar and the dragon and all that. I actually kind of like it better than the color version of it. It looks more powerful that way. Whereas the color version is disjointed, but that's again just me.
And I think black and white sometimes shows up just how good or not certain artwork is. Because I mean, I know there's been one or two things, not wanting to go off topic much, but I mean, there's one or two stories I've got in black and white by Barry Windsor Smith, and I think, well, I don't like them at all. I think they're awful. And then I've mentioned that on Facebook before, and people have like come back at me and said, "Oh no, they're not." And then when I have, if I've actually had chance to see the same thing, the same issue in colour, and then I must admit, I think, well, yeah, now I look at it in colour, it doesn't look so bad, but in black and white, it were like, ooh, you know, like the proportions are awful, you know. So it really shows up the skill of the artist, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's just, let me look at Omat that Burn did, because that was meant to be black and white. And
yeah,
that reads so much better than if it was just had the color removed.
Now, if anybody at IDW is listening, or anybody at DC that's in charge of the compact editions, please give us OMAC. Give us the Burn OMAC series. I don't care if you do it in color, though I prefer it in black and white. I don't want to keep pulling out the original copies, because since they're in the prestige format, every time you read it, you ruin it. And I mean, I've got multiple copies, but I just don't want to ruin them. So please, it's time to make an absolute edition or a compact edition.
There's a trade because it doesn't exist as a trade anywhere.
Yeah. Now, again, you know, they said that the stats got lost, but they did get found again. I know they got found again, so I don't know why they wouldn't want to go ahead and make it. And they forced Byrne to do the inks in a certain way, so he couldn't do the Wally Wood style of using the duo shade, so that they could print it in color. So, you know, they should have done that by now, but they lost the stats. They found them later when they were getting ready to move to California, because it fell behind a cabinet or something. Behind the scanner where they were doing all that. Anyway, all that being said, I think we have said everything else we need to say. And I'm going to go ahead and what are you showing us, Tim?
I'm showing that's just for Nigel. That's something I picked up when we were in Japan at a toy store. It's a Spider-Man
Tommy car.
Yeah.
A Spider-Man car he never had. Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Little peanut, like that little goofy looking little car too.
All right. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us for this and let you know that we are going to be back pretty soon. I know that there's some Alpha Flight still coming, and we'll be continuing the journey on Iron Fist too. So with that being said, we'd like to hear what you think. So please write us. Let us know in Facebook. Let us know on our email address, gottagetburned@gmail.com. Or you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. Does anybody have anything else they want to say before we go?
No, I think you said it all.
Well, Nigel, this is Nigel Spink. That's Kurt Greenfield. That's Tim Elliott. My name is Brian Hughes. So long, and have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to GottaGetBurned@gmail.com. That's GottaGetBurned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.